Succession number 4617, reel number 6.
Mr. Armand, reel 6.
Well, after we received the Rangoon, we settled. We went back to Plymouth to restart our journey back to Aden again. And of course, whereas we'd taken 3 weeks to come out, to come home, which was in the form of a holiday, we now had a new skipper, and we were on serious business of returning a new aircraft to the squadron on a war footing. So the trip back was made quite rapidly. In fact, it was made in 10 days. We started off with a Scapa, which was another type of flying boat, which is also a replacement for the Southampton flying boat. And this Scapa was being flown to Alexandria, where two of the squadrons from England had been sent during this emergency of the in Abyssinia. So we started off with a Scapa, and now that one had, we landed at Hurchin, we landed at Bear, but on the way from Bear to Malta, it ran short of fuel. Scapa, and so it had to diverted to Bizerta in Northern Africa, whilst we went on to Malta, and then we carried on to Alexandria, where in fact number 204 squadron was, and a lot of my old friends were still with the squadron. They were based on a ship in Alexandria Harbour, which was the Manella, which was a supply ship providing accommodation and workshop facilities for these two squadrons.
How do you spell the name of the ship?
Manella, M-A-N-E-L-A. There were the two squadrons. There was number 210 from Pembroke Dock and 204 from Plymouth, which were there in Alexandria Harbour. And they'd been re-equipped with scuppers. Well, we stayed there overnight, and then we flew on the next day, right the way down the Suez Canal and past the pyramids, and right down to Port Sudan. This was a long trip, 10.5 hours, and then we were a bit late landing there, I remember, but we couldn't refuel overnight, so we had to stay there overnight until the next day. We refueled in the morning, and the skipper decided he would stay there for the day. So our neighbour could go ashore and get some more food, and we had a relaxing day there then. The next day we went on again, and we should have gone straight to Aden, but on the way the pilot had been in touch with the HMS Norfolk, which was anchored in Perim Island, and our skipper really found that he knew someone on board, I don't know whether it was the captain, but he knew one of the officers on board the Norfolk. So instead of going to Aden, he stopped at Perim overnight, and we landed there, dropped anchor, and the naval ship came over, naval patrol boat came over, and took the two officers over to the Norfolk for dinner. Well, we settled down, and the wind sprung up a bit there that night, and I was looking out, lying in my bunk, looking out, and I realised that I thought we were drifting. So we went on board and on top, and we found, in fact, we were pulling the anchor and drifting away. So we had a bit of a panic, and my the fitter started the two engines, and the wireless man got into the pilot's seat, and I pulled the anchor up, and between us all we got things under control. Then the pilot and his mate, the navigator, they came on board. I can quite imagine what happened. He just said to Jolly Jack, "Get me on board," and Jolly Jack got him on board. He crashed into the side and made a big hole in the side of the boat. But however, he took charge, and the ship, the Norfolk, trailed a line, a grass line, and we went over and we tied up on that. And I had to. We carried leak stoppers on board, which we could, for emergency use, which we could.
What were they called?
Leak stoppers, which you could plug a hole quickly, you know, temporarily, and a bail that set the. We had an automatic an auxiliary power unit for pumping out the bilges, and I set that going and pumped all the water out, and then which was all right overnight, and then early the next morning we carried on again to Aden. There was another episode or two which I'd forgotten on the way, and that was at Malta. When we'd landed on the way back out, we'd landed at Malta, and there was all the boats were the what squadron was that? It was two squadron at Malta. They were moored in they were based at Califrana and were moored in Birgibusa Bay. And these boats were left out normally, and I had a duty patrol boat would go around them all, you see. And we were on the outer buoy, and during the night a gale sprang up and the motorboat didn't go out, and our boat pulled its moorings and dragged its moorings back, caught one of the scuppers and took that with it, and came back, and they were both on the rocky shore in the morning. And when we went down, there was my boat with on the shore, and around Malta they put barbed wire right the way around the island. At that time, this was another of the emergency procedures that went on. That barbed wire around, and it was fastened with angle iron, and there was a great with angle iron, and there was a big piece of angle iron right up through the hull of my boat. It was firmly secured in the ground, and the only way to get it out, I had to go underwater and saw this inch and a half each way angle iron, quarter inch angle iron, and to saw it off. You can imagine how long it took. Take a deep breath and go down and saw like mad, and all the crew took it in turns to go down, and we managed it, and the wingtip float was damaged. We took that off and put two 50 gallon barrels on, sealed barrels in place, and then we taxied it across to the slipway of the flying boat base, pulled it out of the water and repaired it.
Did that mean a court of inquiry?
There was a unit inquiry, yes, but just confined to the commanding officer of the unit, who would put it in his service record, I suppose. It only delayed us there for one day. They got buckled to and repaired the float for us, and repaired the hole in the hull, and we got underway again. So going back to Aden again, and so the next few months we didn't do a lot of flying while we were there. A bit of navigation, a bit of bomb aiming, and bombing practice. A few trips across to Berbera, Makala, Perim, and carrying political people and odd military. Colonels, you know, not a great deal of activity as far as we were concerned. It was purely a waiting game.
Did you see any sign of the Italians?
No, no, we saw no sign at all. And in fact, part of our time was spent there. They re-equipped the number 8 squadron, which the squadron permanently based there. They re-equipped them with Wildebeest aircraft. And we went up and helped, a lot of our people went up there and helped put them together. These were brought out in big, huge packing cases, brought out by sea, and then were erected at the base at Comaxa. So we left there in Aden. There wasn't a lot to do there. The climate was, after Basra, the climate was quite reasonable. It was a steady 85, I suppose, 85 to 90, and it wasn't too bad. The only unhappy sort of time we had there, we had a mysterious illness called dengue fever. And this was a fever which gave you a very high temperature and a bit of delirium sometimes. One or two people had delirium. It lasted about a fortnight, and very enervating sort of disease, left you very weak afterwards. But other than that, we were quite happy there. We lived in this school, which was on top of the hill, a school which had been a native school, and the native children had been oosted out or moved elsewhere anyway, and we moved into this stone building. Our officers moved to permanent accommodation up at Comaxa, except for a duty officer who stayed down at the moorings with us. And the senior NCOs, they put them in some straw basher type of huts on top of the seawall.
What do you mean by a basher type of hut?
Well, they were made of straw and light wood temporary structures, and they put this on top of the big sea wall, where they could catch a bit of breeze. We were our base was just inside where this building was. There was a line of hills alongside the sea, and about just through the village of Makala, coming from Steamer Point, which is Aden, to Makala, towards Comaxa. And we were about 4 miles short of Comaxa, and they called the corner Windy Corner. There was a bit of breeze blowing through there, and the school was on top of the hills, and there was a tunnel which went through the hills on a road into Crater. Crater was the famous the infamous village where the
Mad Mitchell
eventually quelled the mob. Yes, there were two entrances into Crater. One was through the Crater Pass, which led through the hills, and the other one was through this tunnel and then to a more open way into the town. So, and our base was built just inside where the workshops and were intended workshops, and the marine section and motorboat section and the transport section were held. We had a slipway which we could pull a boat out of the water, but only by manhandling it. We used to get lots and lots of natives and everybody gather around with ropes and pull the boat out of the water. We had a couple of whalers there which we sailed for recreation, and we could, but if we wanted to swim, well, down at Steamer Point there was an area of sea which had been railed off. There were sharks there, of course, and an area of sea which was railed off and from the to keep the sharks and out in which you could swim safely there.
How did you get on with the people in Adam?
They were very, very friendly. Very friendly, and certain areas which were out of bounds to us, the village of Sheikh Hoffman, the people there were tended to be raiders and thieves, and we weren't allowed in there. But at Steamer Point, which was, I suppose, the army were there, the naval people were down there. British were very British presence was very marked down there, I suppose. We were where we were at our squadron. We only had a few natives who helped with cleaning and manhandling equipment, really. That otherwise we were just self-contained, you know. There.
Were they good workers?
Oh yes, yes, they were good workers. Yes, and in fact, wherever we were, the native populations were always good. There was no barbarism, or you know, they were good workers and very friendly. One couldn't complain at all about them. We were, remember, we were still the British Empire. The British were the Lord and Masters everywhere we went. And
so when did you leave Aden?
Well, we left Aden about, I think it was in August. Let me just look for a moment in my flying logbook. We left Aden to return to Basra in July 1936, and we'd been there just short of a year, and our commanding officer decided that he had the authority to decide which route we returned to Basra, so he decided that we should go back up to Alexandria, fly up the Red Sea to Alexandria, where the whole squadron would have a short break, a holiday, before going returning back to Basra. So we set it off about the end of July 1936 with squadron as a whole, and flew in stages back to up to Alexandria, where we moored in the harbour at Alexandria. The emergency was over by that time, although the two squadrons that had been detached to Alexandria were still there, but they were preparing to go home. And we moored there, but Alexandria Harbour was rather crowded, and after we'd been there a week, the CO decided that he didn't like it there, and so he moved out, and we moved to Abukir Bay. Abukir was the station, an RAF station in Egypt, and which was quite close by the bay, and so we moored the flying boats in the harbour in Abukir Bay, and we lived ashore in tents in Abukir camp, and we had a very nice time there. We had no duties apart from a safety guard on each boat all the time. Otherwise we were free to go to Alexandria, go down to the pyramids or be on holiday, more or less, you see. And we spent a month there, and then we were all due to go. So I remember that we had a favourite bar in Alexandria, where we all used to use this bar, all of our squadron, that is, and it was called the New Inn in Beer Street in Alexandria, and a very friendly owner, and one or two girls there with a bit of band which used to have a dance in the evenings, and very pleasant to us all together. And the night we were due to leave, the owner of this place said he would give us a free evening. And
was he an Egyptian?
Yes, he was an Egyptian, yes. He gave us a free evening, and he closed the bar to anyone else, just our squadron, you see. And we had a jolly good evening back on board, on there.
And so this was free drinks, was it?
Free drinks all evening, yes, yes. And then when we left there, we went straight back on board the boats. and sort of it was pretty late, I suppose, or pretty early. We didn't go to sleep anyway. We sort of more or less we got ready to take off again, and it was just after dawn. We had a long trip. We were going to fly straight overland to Albania, and all six flying boats all started up together, and we all had a full load of petrol, and rather heavily laden with spares and everything we could carry. And the first one went to take off. The pilot pulled it off too quickly, and it got airborne and crashed back down and smashed its tail off. And that was a good start. Anyway, the rest of us got airborne, and I think it would be 4 or 5 hours we were steadily flying away in very loose formation spread over the sky. And I got some breakfast for those who wanted it. No one was very interested. We were feeling a bit day after the night before, you know, and they had an automatic pilot on these things, and we were flying along quite happily. And on our boat there was a sudden bang, and I sat up to see what was going on, and everything looked normal. The wireless operator was at his desk, my fitter was at his desk, and the two pilots were in the seat forward and looked. But as I watched, the nose went into the air, and we started climbing up to the sky. What the deuce is going on? So I watched, and then heard the pilot start shouting. So I went up forward to see what was going wrong, and as I got forward, the nose tipped over, and the next thing we were just screaming down to the desert. And I said, "What's wrong?" And the pilot said, "Do something." I said, "Well, tell me what's wrong." And so he pointed to the side of his seat. And on these flying boats, the tail unit was a complete tail unit, was adjustable for the angle to balance it when it's in the air. You could increase the dihedral of the tail unit to give a greater lift, or decrease it to give less lift, and this whole unit could be adjusted. Well, this wheel was the means of adjusting. The big wheel was about a foot diameter beside the seat, and he pointed to the wheel. So I felt it, and I couldn't move it. It was jammed solid. I said, it's jammed. He said, "I know it is. Do something." So I started to trace the wires back through to the tail. And these wires seemed to be all right all the way back, but they were slack instead of being taut. And I followed them all the way back, right through the hole, right back deep into the tail, to where they, back in the tail unit, the means of adjustment of this angle was a long screw worm on about with a movement of about 12 inches, and these two cables came back to a sprocket with a chain, and as you pulled, as they moved one way or the other, so the sprocket moved this worm up and down, which gave you the adjustment, the alteration in the angle. Well, when I got back there, I found that this chain was off the sprocket altogether. And as I looked at it, the whole unit jumped from the low position to the top position. And I shut my eyes, and I thought the whole thing was going to disintegrate. I shut my eyes and sort of clung onto the framework, and nothing happened. And I opened them again, and the crew were still, they were moving up and down, the other two, the spare passenger, the fitter had left his seat and was moving up and down the hull to help to balance the boat, you see. And the wireless operator was tapping out, trying to tap out to the CO what was going wrong, that we had no control, while the other boats just carried on. And I didn't know at the time, but apparently the other boats carried on. The CO did one circuit, and then he carried on because he thought he was going to be short of fuel. And he sent a message out that one flying boat thought to have crashed in the desert. And in the meantime, we were going up and down, porpoising through the sky.
Like a switchback.
Like a switchback with no fore and aft control, you see. But anyway, what had happened was that the it was a faulty design, and the locking screw on this cog at the back, the locking screw had come out, and the large nut had unscrewed, and all the ball bearings had fallen out, and the whole gear had just fallen apart, disintegrated. And anyway, I looked at this and I realised that I had to do something, and so I had spare cable for splicing controls as needed, and I went to my workshop, big workshop cupboard that we had there, and fetched this cable, and I wound it round the struts and round the frame and round and round and round, and managed to trap this whole structure tight together to stop any movement, and then went forward to see what sort of control he had. And but it was very tail heavy, so we carried the two spare propellers, spare magnetos, which were in quite big magnetos in a big waterproof steel lined boxes, carried them, drums of water, spare 5 gallon drums of oil, carried everything forward and piled it up all around the pilot. We managed to get it flying level, and he turned down to the Dead Sea. This happened over a man. If you can imagine a position of a man, it's just sort of a bit further flying from the Mediterranean. It's further inland than the Dead Sea. So we turned back towards the Dead Sea, and he went south and made a long, slow approach from south to north. And as we were coming in, he had me mount my Lewis gun. He said, "This is hostile country." So I had to crawl over all this gear that we brought forward, find my Lewis gun, put it on board. He insisted on a loaded pan of ammunition being the gun being loaded, and pulled the scarf ring forward. The scarf ring, its normal position was on a slide rail just after of the gun pit forward, and had to pull it forward and then put one's head up through. And so as we came into land, I was there standing with my Lewis gun looking at the cliffs either side. We touched down in the north side, and he taxied towards Kalia, which was a chemical extraction plant, or was in those days, where they, from the salts in the Dead Sea. And he taxied up there, and he said, "Get your anchor out." But he wouldn't let me pull my golf ring back, wouldn't let me move the gun. So I had a 60-pound anchor to pull out through the scarf ring and assemble. The flukes came off, and the crossbar at the top had to slide through, of course, you know, the way an anchor is. And I had that to push out through the small scarf ring with a mounted, loaded Lewis gun and get ready to drop. So as we'd... as we dropped anchor, then he switched off engines, and